It's terribly important that we have, hopefully, an intelligent and a broad enough discussion to be able to put sensational headlines, terrible reporting. You could burn your issue of Time magazine if that slick paper burned properly, and that would be the greatest use you could put it to. Most other articles I've read, all TV I've seen, has misrepresented and campaigned and editorialized and has deprived you of information that is essential to the American people to assist in making terribly important decisions about our national forest. And I'm going to, and this is a much bigger issue than the national forest, but I think the issue is focused on the national forest. It's focused on all forests, but it's focused most on the national forest. And to be really efficient with our time and relevant, that's what we need to talk about. A very short Forest Service history is essential to put this all into perspective. As I'm sure quite a few of you know, the national forests were brought into being as national forests, as national as forest reserves prior to the turn of the century. As a matter of fact, the Organic Act was signed on June 4th, 1897. I particularly remember that date because June 4th is my birthday. Not 1897, 1933, a little later. And but those were forest reserves. And if you remember anything about your history, of course, Teddy Roosevelt was a champion of stopping the ripoff of our public lands for grazing purposes, for uncontrolled mining operations, uncontrolled timbering operations, and the like. And he was a champion of introducing wise use or conservation and preservation. And they're different, and we'll see that. In 1905, the National Forest finally became a matter of law, and in some wonderful midnight skullduggery by then-President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and we had a National Forest system. The early years of the National Forest were spent on custodial stewardship. We put out fires. We got the sheep herders and the miners and the loggers under control, and the early rangers were bad looking dudes, and they rode horses and wore sidearms, and they dealt rather aggressively with getting protection for those lands. So we had a high custodial mission. That mission broadened in the early history, and for those of you who sat in on my discussion of wilderness history, realize the Forest Service gave birth to the Wilderness Conference concept through some real giants within the agency. Bob Marshall, Arthur Carhart, Aldo Leopold, assisted by some champions within the citizen group that resulted in a wilderness system. All of this was going on through the 30s, and there was a slow increase in other uses of national forest lands, and our mission moved a little from custodial to the provision of a multiplicity of uses. Holden Village is an example of one of those uses. It is on national forest land, your national forest land, under permit. Many, many other special use permits, recreation, water supply, grazing, under control. Timber harvest, but not in a big way, but under control. And along came the, and that was all embraced in an act in 1960, and became policy of the United States that the National Forest would provide multiple use sustained yield act. Sustained yield, the concept being that we would wisely use resources so we had a sustained yield forever. That's based in Christian theology. It came to us from Gifford Pinchot, the first chief, who was very much a utilitarian Christian. Creation gave us fruits and gifts. It was our duty to use them wisely and sustain them for other generations. At the same time, as we discussed in the wilderness session, but to refresh your minds and those of you who weren't there, we had Mirror with another Christian philosophy, and that is the wonderful spiritual value of the gifts of creation. And at some times they were at loggerheads, and at some times Muir and Gifford Pinchot were powerful advocates of a joint philosophy. But they essentially split on utilitarianism, wise use conservation, and preservation. That brought us, it must bring us, in this terribly short history, to 1946. And what happened in 1946? What important event in the history of the United States? Come on, some of you are my age. The end of the Second World War. Sure. Yeah, what happened? The boys came home as men, and they married, and we had a baby boom. And we had a housing shortage, and we had a need, a crying need, for lumber in the United States. And that was really the impetus, though there was timber harvest before that. That was the impetus of the large-scale timber operations in the national forests. There was a social need, an economic need, a congressional and an agency response, and we sallied forth and produced large quantities of wood out of the very productive national forests. The Pacific Northwest region, of which I've been a part for all of my career, 34 years, is the largest producer, though there are national forests in some 40 states or more, 190 million acres. 25% of all softwood is cut in the Pacific Northwest. This is focused on the issue of owls and ancient forests, which we'll quickly get into, is focused in the Pacific Northwest, but is a national issue, a very real national issue, as you'll see when I talk about the politics that are going on today relative to it. And it is, in my view, a social justice issue and a very big part and significant part of the whole planet's environmental needs for consideration and responsibility on our part. Okay, so we're in the timber production business. The forestry schools, of which I'm a product, were teaching that they were teaching that the primary value of forests, and then let me say the national forests, was to produce timber. And the production of water, range and forage and wildlife and scenic values and recreation opportunities were all attendant values. But the primary value and the driving value and the great responsibility of foresters was, quote, to get the cutout, unquote. And that was a driving influence on the early years of my career. And much of our language is based on, and I'm writing an analysis of the language of forestry as I have known it, and debunking an awful lot of it. Decadent forests, or decadent forests, if you like, is a forestry term. It is, and it's back to that Christian ethic of utilitarianism. If a tree dies, it's a wasted tree. We know now ecologically that's ridiculous, but that in fact was a tenet of forestry when I, just a short 35 years ago, when I went and graduated from forestry school. So given that background, you begin to see how we got to where we are today. In 1970, what happened in 1970 socially in the United States, or about that time, we attribute it to the 70s. Earth Day, of course. And Earth Day triggered what?
Gas prices.
The environmental consciousness and movement in the United States. First attributed probably to a combination of little old ladies in tennis shoes and hippies. Okay? I heard you snicker. And they were not the sole possessors of environmental concern, but we sort of thought so at first. And then all of a sudden the rest of the nation got pretty serious about it. And we began to see, and then we saw what I did the first day, the view of the planet from outer space. We began to see that we're very small, that we are finite, our resources are finite, our populations, world populations expanding. So we had developing a strong concern and sense of new responsibility to the environment. That gets us to the present situation. And I'm doing an awful lot of shortcutting here, but you have to have this information, I think, in some sense of perspective. It gets us to the current situation. In 1976, one more niche that must be filled, the Congress responded to the expressions of the American people and their concern about how the national forests were being managed. So it isn't today. 1976. There was about 3 years of intensive debate, which I was part, I happened to be a part of it on the side of wilderness because I was doing major wilderness study at the time. And we saw the passage of the National Forest Management Act after much debate. I want to read a very, very short statement by Hubert Humphrey that he made at the time of the passage of the act. And I think it gives you a clue to what the Congress intended, but I think the Forest Service, I know the Forest Service collectively, not individually perhaps, but collectively was relatively deaf to this message. When the act was passed, and Senator Hubert Humphrey was one of the prime architects, he said this simple statement, but very important one, "The days have ended when the forest must be viewed only as trees, and trees viewed only as timber. The soil and water, the grasses and shrubs, the fish and wildlife, and the beauty that is the forest must become integral parts of resource managers' thinking and action." I said the Forest Service collectively, I think, was deaf to the message. We did not respond as responsibly, I believe, and as aggressively as we should have. There was an institutionalized value to the Forest Service in harvesting timber. It drove our budgets, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, and we had become dependent on the budgets that the timber program and its attendant road program provided for this management of the national forest. Congress, and it has a shared responsibility, I won't say guilt, because I don't think guilt's an appropriate word, a shared responsibility, because in fact they did not fund the other resource values, so-called. I call them now the primary resource values, and when my timber people say, "What do you mean primary?" I say, "I mean all values other than timber." And so the primary values, and I believe they are those when you talk about ecosystems, health of ecosystems, fish and wildlife, water, scenery, and I think spiritual value, are the primary values. And Congress did not fund those. They still aggressively funded the timber program after they passed the law in 76 with the good senators, late senators' eloquent words and advice. The Congress of the United States, set the target for timber harvest. The Forest Service makes an advisory target. It was consistently raised through some administrations, not all. So that's an important fact to understand. The Congress is a co-player in the situation we find ourselves. The agency, of course, is a handy place to pass blame to if you run for office. But the realities, and I think we all know them, is Congress is a co-player. As we got into the 80s, and we passed Rare and Endangered Species Act, many other pieces of environmental legislation, very important legislation, environmental action groups, of which I'm a member, in the case of the Wilderness Society and the Audubon Societies, the action groups and the leadership of environmental concern and action in the United States began to use the environmental laws for the value they represented, an opportunity to stop things they felt were inappropriate on their national forests, on our national forests. And so we had a long series of challenges in the form of administrative appeals, in the form of litigation, and we come to find ourselves in one of those cases, and there are more, but the primary one that's caught all the attention and reached the White House as a national issue, and that is the preservation of the need to preserve the spotted owl as a rare and endangered species. The spotted owl has been identified by the Forest Service and the biologists of the Forest Service as an indicator species of old growth ecosystems. And when I say indicator species, it's a wildlife species which serves as a surrogate for all of the other living things within an old growth ecosystem. It just happens to be one that's very handy to be able to use under the theory that if you do well for an indicator species, you'll do well for all the others. And so it is the surrogate. There are many others. And we'll stick to that one because it became the cause celeb of the current situation. Remember this, and understand clearly, the issue is not spotted owls. Whenever you want to do something in the United States, it's always wise to wrap your, dealing with natural environment or nature, it's always wise to wrap your cause in either fur, feathers, or perhaps scales. Though the snail darter didn't do too well, it's hard to love a fish. It's easy to love an owl. It's wonderful to love Smokey. So we did it ourselves. We didn't want people going around being promiscuous with fire, so we got Smokey Bear. And people like Smokey, and they listen to Smokey, and young children tell parents when they're careless with their matches and all it goes. Okay, so the spotted owl is a surrogate for more than just old growth. From a scientific standpoint, it's a political surrogate, and it's a very good one. We cast it up to be one when we identified it as an indicator species. The issue, the real, true issue, is the integrity of ecosystems, not just old growth. It's also easy to get very, very excited, spiritually uplifted, by walking in an old growth stand. And of course, one movement entitles them Cathedral Forests, and it's a very apt description. It's very uplifting for me as both a person that has found spirituality in wilderness and is also a professional forester to walk down here and just look at this very small grove of impressive white pine close to the volleyball yard. So old growth has captured an ancient forest. I really love that. Ancient forests became another coined term that to catch the public's attention, because there's a very large apathetic public, as we know, and it's very difficult to get a broad public spectrum interested in issues that organized activity groups, such as the ones I mentioned, know are true and honest issues. So anything you can use to get their attention is fair game and should be used, and I support that. Ancient forest was a wonderful term, so is cathedral forest. We must examine it, though. Think of this term for a moment. I want to preserve ancient forests. What do you think would be the motive of someone that aspires to that lofty cause? What do you think how would you describe their motive?
Sensitive.
Okay, but what is it they want to get done, Harry?
Preservation.
Pardon?
Preservation.
Okay, they want, preservation of what?
Of some system that's been operating on the planet that's natural, continual, it's been going.
You just heard that from another scientist. Yeah. See, I don't think that's quite right. I think that is the legitimate goal. See, and what Mark is saying is preservation of a system and the revolvement of that system. But in fact, when you read populist writing on this, populist writing or misinformation, that's all media, what you get is preserve all these old trees forever. Well, I told one group that I go along with that, but I give them another cause first. It was much more important to me. I would like them to work on preservation of ancient foresters. Because I'd be a very much a direct beneficiary. And as I look to retiring on the 30th of November this year, and then going on with all the causes that I'm in now, but at a maybe more leisurely pace, as I look forward to that retirement, you see, then I wouldn't have to. I could work for 300-400 years at this, and I would love it. So I think you see my point. We're dealing with living things here, folks, and the whole word of preservation applied to living things, and it is in many people's minds. I want the redwoods to stand as they do forever. The redwoods are doomed to not stand as they do forever. They will die, and they will be replaced within the national park by Douglas fir and tan oak. And then, 1,000 years or more from now, we can rename it the Douglas Fir Tan Oak National Park. Because we have interrupted two mighty powers in an ecosystem in the coastal redwoods that we cannot replicate. And one is massive flooding, and the other one is massive fire. And we have taken those out of the system. And then we said we preserved the redwoods, and that, of course, is very inaccurate. But we did it in our time, and so we feel very comfortable and good about it. And we even add the wonderful statement that we did it for our children's children. I think what we did is preserve our children's children's options, and they'll make very intelligent decisions, thank you, because we gave them the opportunity, and I'm glad we did. But you must keep in mind, we're dealing with living, changing, vibrant, wonderful, complex, non-understood ecosystems. And that's what this issue's about. And so a young forest is absolutely as important as an old forest. Because if you want old forests in the future, you will have young forests today. The question is, how many shall be left to go through natural processes, and how many acres shall be utilized for the benefits of humankind, but in a manner that leaves the ecosystem intact? And I'm going to take you to a concept called New Perspectives, which contains the hope, not the answer, but the hope of an answer that we all must find together. I have some other things here. Well, we've got time, I'll use them. But I want to be careful, we get some various essential elements. We found ourselves last year, I believe it was, with Forest Service leadership meeting in Washington, D.C. at our annual winter meeting being addressed by Senator Leahy, and who just happens to chair the relevant committee that has to do with the Forest Service. And he made a very excellent speech. It's interesting because it was written by about 45 forests, unwittingly, by about 45 forest supervisors who wrote a letter to the chief following a national meeting of forest supervisors. Senator Leahy, and giving the chief advice on what we should do to change. Senator Leahy had one of his staffers, a very longtime friend of mine, and was one of our wilderness rangers for some time, take this good advice given by the Forest Service field leadership to the Forest Service national leadership and wrote a speech and gave it to the Forest Service. God bless him. And he's a few quotes from that speech. Remember now, these are 44 forest supervisors talking to the chief through a senator, and with the senator getting lots of editorial credit. Despite the dramatic change in public views, the Forest Service has been slow to respond. In fact, timber harvest peaked in 1987 to an all-time high of nearly 13 billion board feet. Many in Congress feel that the Forest Service has not done enough to protect the environment. Just for the record, a check. Senator Leahy voted yay on the 13 billion board feet in 1987. But going on now and getting to the advice really of the supervisors to their chief, our chief. Too often, the Forest Service has given achieving timber harvest levels a higher priority than preserving the rest of the forest ecosystems. Too often, it has ignored the field professionals, there's where the forest supervisors come in, who believe that nationally imposed timber goals are unrealistic and cannot be met without sacrificing the rest of the forest. My words are here. I've been championing this for 20 years. God bless Senator Leahy. We must move away from current forest management practices driven by timber targets. We must move away from a mindset that views other uses as environmental considerations and constraints. If you talk to any Forest Service people in this region, and I've been on every ranger district in the region twice or more in the last 2 years, they'll tell you that Buescher says it's okay to use some four-letter words in mixed company, but never use constraints or trade-offs because that's foul language not fit for the ears of the female gender. To reduce scenery, clean water, healthy wildlife and fish communities to constraints and trade-offs to the timber program is obscene. But in fact, is the language of the mathematical computer model used to calculate timber output harvests in the forest plant. The reason being, computers are stupid. They tell me they're going to make them intelligent, that scares me. But they're stupid. They can add and subtract because we show them how to. And so we had to communicate to the computer by telling them these things were constrained so it would lower timber yields. But unfortunately, that intruded the cranial cavities of people, which are intelligent. And they adopted, some adopted that thing. It must stop. Senator Leahy and his 44 forest supervisor advisors are correct. Lastly, from Senator Leahy, what the Forest Service must recognize is that foresters are responsible for preserving water, air, and soil quality, for reducing acid rain, for maintaining biological diversity, the new perspectives, and it comes here first, for managing the national forest system is an important and welcome step in the right direction. Not only does this approach the preservation of old growth ecosystems, but it allows for selective harvests. It does a great deal more than that, Senator. And we're going to examine that very carefully. New perspectives, and it's almost to the point of being institutionalized, and so now I'm calling a new way of looking at things. New perspectives is a movement, a grassroots movement, in the Forest Service. I am well identified with the individuals and included among the individuals that started it. It actually began first in the field on the H.G. Andrews Experiment Forest on the Willamette National Forest, between a research community working there and a young ranger named Steve Eubanks that has been a long comrade of mine and in some cases a tutor. I've been his mentor. It has expanded swiftly as a grassroots movement and has many definitions, and that's appropriate because we're thinking our way through and feeling our way through this, and it is a wonderfully dynamic happening. I'm going to deal with just three field-located individuals and their perspective of what New Perspectives is about. I'll give you the first definition and then interrupt the next two with what I think the appropriate definition is from my perspective and how my point of view on New Perspectives. This comes from a individual named Mel Greenup, who is a longtime silviculturist on the Siskiyou National Forest, one of the most complex ecosystems and geographic provinces that any national forest contains, in a very difficult management situation. Mel has been a champion for a long time of a better way. And he defined New Perspectives this way. It is a land management philosophy that recognizes the importance of diverse ecosystems and their processes as the foundation for sustaining resource values and uses. The first consideration of the land manager is to maintain or enhance ecosystem diversity, productivity, and renewability for the long-term well-being of people. I think Mel is partly right. I think the other people and some realities have to be a part of the definition. And so I've taken the drawing in an equilateral triangle for two reasons. Anybody know anything about geometry? What's the strongest geometric figure? That's easy, isn't it? Equilateral triangle. And in fact, we build bridges with a complex of equilateral triangles, and so on it goes. And that's to demonstrate this. These things are co-equal. There is no superior position, nor should one be taken. We did that with timber, and that gave economics a superior position. Economic values are one of the three. Ecological integrity is one of the three. Social and spiritual values, social can be recreation, many other things, scenery. Social and spiritual values, and I learned to intensify my appreciation after all these years of living and working in wilderness, that Spirituality and spiritual values are one of the foremost values of the National Forest System and its wilderness portion, not just its wilderness portion, by coming here to Hobart. In the last 4 years of being on teaching staff and being on the wilderness, being privileged to help lead the wilderness spirituality retreat in the wintertime. And so it's greatly intensified it. I say with some pride and to share with you, fellow Holden villagers, that the Forest Service in the Pacific Northwest now regularly includes spiritual values in our discussion of wilderness managers and in discussions among ourselves that is directly traceable to my time here. My definition then gets away from constraints and trade-offs, the obscenities, and looks very simply at a search for compatibilities between these three. Now, the compatibilities may many times heavily weigh on an essential protection or even preservation of ecological integrity. It does not mean each one of these get one-third of the pie, because there is no pie. We are dealing with a decision-making allocation process, and we must find compatibility. The reason that any questions about that before I move off of that?
Who decides the strength of each of those? Because it really makes a difference on who's in power, I suspect, and who has control.
Oh yeah, and as I said, this is a happening process, and we don't know the answer to your question. So we think that, I'll tell you how, in two more readings, how one ranger district and one young deputy forest supervisor intended to happen relative to who plays in the game and what their role will be. So I'll get back to the answer. But we're still finding, we're still on the search. We're beginning the search. And so we're very much like the people looking for the Nile.
You talk about the ecological integrity. Are you also talking about Forest Service or the forest industry doing the reforestation? And I mean,
yeah,
there's less diversity.
Yeah, as you and I know, Tom, that when I isolate, and I think all the rest of you do know, when I bring this discussion more sharply focused on the Forest Service, I do it for two reasons. My greatest knowledge lies there. My greatest sense of responsibility and dedication lies there. And in fact, we're going to have to lead the movement. We're going to have to show them how. And so, but Tom is exactly right. The holders of the industrial forests of the United States must accept their responsibilities, and citizens are going to make them do that if they don't choose to do it themselves. It's happening in California as we speak through citizen initiatives. And I believe that much greater than that, the small woodlot owner has to. And the United States has to begin to reward them for long-term vision, because it's very difficult when you own a woodlot to think in 100-year terms when you're 55 years old. And yet they have the largest supply of potential timber in the United States for the world. We are an enormous source of renewable forest for the world. Unless, of course, global warming gets completely out of hand, we become a desert. And so given the present situation, at least, we have large extended responsibilities. We have not used our privately owned forests wisely. We have attacked and destroyed them. In the worst spirit of Genesis, I think the mistaken spirit of Genesis, go out and conquer. The reason I titled this and I went back to this is I've talked about owls, ancient forests, and beyond. Think a moment about this situation, the social justice, and then we'll talk world environments and how this all links. Here at Holden, I have been impressed, inspired, moved by discussions of Christian ethical responsibilities to all people in this nation, in this world. I have been struck this week by our effort to emancipate, to reach out, to seek the strength of diversity that comes in the human community when we work together and we shed all of the biases and the hatreds and the bigotries that has been characterized in our society. But you cannot aspire to those lofty goals and then operate separately on the preservation question of the fruits of creation. There is an enormous need for low-cost housing. It will be built of building materials, some of which will be wood. We talk of recycling garbage here and styrofoam. Either recycle or don't accept it. Holden taught me a wonderful trick. The Forest Service is now using another export from Holden to the Forest Service. I came here 2 years ago and they had a big display up and it said that we will not accept styrofoam and should not accept or use styrofoam because they do not recycle. It is recyclable, but they don't recycle it. And I found out that when the Holden places orders, they write right on the order, do not pack in styrofoam or we will return. Use biodegradable material. And everything came in torn paper and everything else like it used to. And I thought, hey, that's really slick. So I get home, I ordered some tools. I usually get a $40 wood turning chisel in a box this big because the company is notorious for losing them. And so they don't put it in a box that fits it. They put it in a great big box so they won't lose them. Then they fill that with styrofoam. And so I got all the damn styrofoam, And so I started writing on my order. I wrote on that tool order. And guess what? Came in paper. It's the power of the consumer. And so I said, well, if it works for Dick Buescher and it works for Holden Village, it'll work for the United States Forest Service. So I go down to we got a central supply. I had a rubber stamp made on Earth Day. And it says, the United States Forest Service supports recycling of biodegradable materials. We will not accept any shipment that comes in styrofoam, polystyrene, or whatever the scientific name was. Wham, goes on every order that goes out. We don't get it anymore. What we got is a call from a congressman. We had no difficulty dealing with it. And so, it can be done. But social responsibility has to come into this. Social justice. We cannot make the decisions based on that large portion of our society that subscribes to the environmental movement and to the organizations. And as I said the other day, and like in my very own home, places copies of Audubon Sierra, Wilderness Magazine and others on very expensive coffee tables, when in fact there are many homes in the United States don't have coffee or cups, let alone a table. And so it can't be taken out of that context. It is no justification to abuse the ecosystem. It's quite the contrary. We leave no legacy to the unfortunate members of our society that we want to bring in to a living standard that they have a right to expect by taking care of the ecosystem. That is an immediate social responsibility. So don't misunderstand my social justice as a reason to go out and cut some more boards. I'm not telling you that. In fact, we ought to recycle boards. I find it really weird that we recycle paper, but we tear down houses in the city and burn them with a cap, when in fact they have better lumber than we can mill today within those houses. And we should be recycling the houses and the concrete. We did the bricks for a while till we couldn't find people to do the hand labor to get the cement off, and of course there's ways to do that. So don't misunderstand me when I introduce social justice. Understand me. And lastly, world environments. We are a speck on the globe. We like to think we're the most important speck. But we're only a speck on the globe. But we're a wonderfully productive, creative, technically astute, and intelligent speck. And we have well-established Christian ethics. They need renewal, but we have well-established Christian ethics. And so the United States must become a leader. We have been the exporter of bad habits. We have been the exporter of greed, and we have successfully exported it. I mentioned the other day that even Vlachos, one of the many futurists that you can pay to talk to you, once said to a Forest Service group that 10 years ago told us that the world kind of liked having the United States because they could envy us in our lifestyle, but woe be to the world if we ever exported our lifestyle. Well, we did that. We've exported this successfully to Japan, successfully to Germany, and to some other countries. And in fact, we've done that at the great cost of the southern hemisphere and the equatorial belt of the world. And we have caused a greater depression, starvation, and death of people in the process. And so a redistribution of the world's environmental values and products is a part of this whole discussion, and that's why I take great umbrage with much of what I read, because in fact it's so point focused on saving an owl. You cannot talk about saving an owl by itself. I told you I'd tell you two other perspectives on new perspectives, and again from grassroots individuals in the Forest Service, and then we're going to have time for dialogue. And I'll close with two very, very short quotes from books that I will recommend to you. And one, my recommendation may well surprise you, because it does not treat the Forest Service in any sense a flattering way, but I find no inaccuracies in the reporting, and that's what you must have as truth. This particular one is comes from the words, and it'll be a very short part of it, from a young woman named Nancy Graybeal, who is a deputy forest supervisor on the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest, the third most productive forest in the United States. And I knew Nancy Graybeal some years ago when she was a silviculturist who designed silvicultural management and timber sales on the Siuslaw National Forest, and was very concerned because I found Nancy to be a modern day advocate of getting the cutout, albeit by a better science, but not a better design. And I was very concerned. Well, Nancy Graybeal has grown and changed, and she's become what she herself calls, some others, a giant in the effort to change our perspective. And here's how she did. Here's the 5 points that she includes in her message to the people of her forest and the Mount Hood and to whom she was speaking. New perspectives is not just innovative silviculture. It is a total philosophy of forest management driven by 5 essential principles. And the first one, I was glad to see here because it was left out of Mel Greenup's. People and their cultures and economies are integral parts of ecosystems. Sustainability of ecosystems, second one, the sustainability of ecosystems is a better measure of the legacy we leave than our timber production track record or our track record with individual wildlife species. Her third point, what we leave behind on the land, the biological legacy, is as important as what we plan to remove from the land. And the fourth, people from all interests and walks of life, and this starts to get at the question that was asked, how do we get there? People from all interests and walks of life, not just foresters or interdiscipline teams or ecologists or biologists, will shape what new perspectives eventually becomes. And fifth, the best scientific thought will be evident in all that it becomes. She closed with some challenges to her fellow Forest Service people at a meeting attended by about 300 from the two forests. She said most change efforts fail because they are never really tried. I don't fear we'll move too fast. I only fear we'll move too slowly. Let's stop carving the forest into pieces and begin to tie it back together. You're going to hear this suggested again. It is now being suggested by David Brower, the one-time leader of the Sierra Club, and it is called really reconstruction environmentalism. Let's stop carving the forest into pieces and begin to tie it back together. Let's embrace the principles of ecological sustainability and change our programs and practices to reflect them and our timber outputs. Let's begin to blur the distinction between wild and managed. Blur it, not make it sharper. Right now, it's wilderness and a managed forest. Her call is to blur them, and I believe it's true. The public has seen the tree farm approach, first on private lands and on state lands and now on the national forest, and they don't particularly like what they see. In fact, a lot are pretty damn mad about it. Let's see visible change now. And she goes on to say, they don't want, the public does not want to hear about it. They must see change. Let's move forward together. And she has a rally around her concept of giants form, identifying themselves and performing. The last one, before we have a chance to hear your comments and questions, came from an absolutely wonderful happening that I set in motion, and it occurred well beyond my dreams. One of the ranger districts on this forest, the Wenatchee, the Clay Elum Ranger District, happens to be led by the longest tenured ranger in Region 6 of the Forest Service. Bill Lowry has had 22 years as a district ranger, 17 in his present district. And you could draw from that that this might be one of the dinosaurs that was still pursuing the old way. Bill Lowry is a leader among leaders. He has learned and grown from the I Say You Do school of management, and back, by the way, when it worked quite well for him, and has entered the era of empowering his people to lead with him. And so I met with the Clay Elum District. I gave them a challenge to define for themselves the new way of looking at things in implementing the forest plan on the Clay Elum District, and told them no more than that except some of the things you've heard here about what others were thinking. No definition provided, and they did their own work. We met then in a field setting because Forest Service people do a lot better thinking out in the field than they do in an office. And this Forest Service person certainly does. And we added to the group 9 district rangers that I hand-selected from around the region. You got to understand that the district ranger is the most important position in the Forest Service because it is the fourth in a level of 4 line officers, but the one that has their hands on the land and serves the people that own and use it. And so district rangers, in this case Al Murphy for the Chelan District that administers this area, Bill Lowry in his case, was joined by 9 district rangers I hand-selected because I had been out with them and been inspired by their thoughts and their efforts to move away from the traditional and toward the desired future state. And Bill's team laid this paper on them in a presentation, and we had a lot of discussion, went to the field with a group of PhD social scientists that I've also been working with that are a consortium from Oregon State University, University of Washington, Pacific Northwest Research Station, to bring the social value into the ecological question. So that group listened to a team of young people and old people who coalesced on that ranger district to decide that this would be their mission and these would be their 3 goals. They divided the question into internal relationships, relationships with each other, external relationships, relationships with the owners for whom they work. They don't work. See, I've always said I never work for the Forest Service. I don't work for the Forest Service. Forest Service is a non-thing. I work for you. You pay me, and I work for the people that own the National Forest. Everywhere I go, I push at that till they have to either humor me or accept it. They accepted it. And so their view is they work for you too. And lastly, relationship with the land was what they chose, not land stewardship, which still smacks of either custodial or manipulative. Now let me tell you what the words of these people are, and these were not found easily. They brainstormed this, they decided to use a leaderless approach that was founded in some very good group dynamics psychology that they were familiar with. This cover page is interesting. If afterwards some of you want to look at it, it's rather fascinating because a woman on the district, Judy Frazier, who's been 11 years a wilderness management person for whom wilderness rangers work, woke up in the middle of the night and it occurred to her that they'd been brainstorming all day and the prefix RE was being used constantly. And so this whole thing was entitled RE Elum instead of CLE Elum, which is the name of their district. And it's reforest, refocus, respect, refreshing, rehabilitate, it looks like something would come right out of Holden. I mean, it's really super. And like refocus starts with little words and gets big, and so it's more than just the words, it's also the way they're displayed. And they used it the next day. She teamed up with Meg Mitchell, a woman landscape architect and with a master's in recreation planning that's about 10 years ahead of all the rest of us in her thinking. So they put all this, that part together. This is the product, though, of all the people on that Ranger District working together, some of whom are just summer employees still pursuing their education. Here is the mission of the Clio Elm Ranger District as the people that are operating it for you have decided. To create an environment which recognizes and fosters respect for the diversity within social and ecological systems. That's their mission, as they see it. This is their goal in relationships with each other. To have a creative, caring, and responsive organization that efficiently arrives at quality decisions through interaction. Here is their goal in relationship with you, their bosses. To have a systematic approach which embraces a citizen as an integral part of a land stewardship team. Not someone we mail a plan to, get comments, come back, and through some smoke-filled room make a decision. An integral part of a land stewardship team. They are already doing that. Lastly, their goal for relationship with the land. Remember my mention about rehabilitatory responsibilities. To maintain the natural ecosystems and rehabilitate the unacceptably disturbed areas while maintaining the natural resources and human opportunities on the Clio Elm Ranger District. To maintain the natural ecological systems and rehabilitate the unacceptably disturbed areas while maintaining the natural resources and human opportunities of the Clio Elm Ranger District. Okay, after each one of these is a whole set of objectives, very specific, and some action items that they see to get them to step two. This is step one. And so with that, you've got before you the briefest history of, in history of the Forest Service. You have some perspective of the spotted owl as a surrogate for old growth, which is a surrogate for the integrity of our ecosystems. Some thought, perhaps, about how does this all play in the inner city and our responsibilities for social justice. How does it all play in our need to be leaders in world environmental affairs and to lead by example, not lecture? The rest of the world is pretty sick of that too. And so I think with that, I'd really like to hear your reactions, certainly your questions, but maybe more than that, your comments, your thoughts. Yes.
Very interesting what you've had to say. If I project a little bit farther out, if we cut our production from 13 billion to 6 billion board feet over a certain period of time, presumably that's going to have to be made up someplace. One of the construction people I talked to, I asked him what would happen if the price of timber went shot way up, consequent to the alpha that was gone mowing down Yakima. He said they'd probably find substitutes in the form of preformed steel, wood or studs, mm-hmm. the material of the building. But sooner or later, that has to run out also. And if we don't produce the timber here, presumably we have to buy it, say, from Siberia. If you push something down over here, it pops up over here. Could you comment on that? Because this is part of the world environment.
If I didn't know to the contrary, I would have thought I'd put that gentleman there to remind me of something I forgot. It's the other part of the social justice thing, and you're right on. And it links to the world environment. We are capable of and have proven that we can renew a timber resource in this country. We have been given and blessed with the kind of land and climate to do that. If we chose to solely just solve the problem by preservation of natural ecosystems, we would indeed use someone else's. And that would get us into the question of deforestation of the Amazon and other non-temperate or tropical forests, which we all condemn and should, because in fact they're depriving another underprivileged part of our society from a lifestyle that stood them quite well in those jungles. And now we're pushing them out solely to get 4 or 5 years of use out of a land which then becomes useless, because unlike our temperate forests, it cannot be reforested. It can be, cannot be re-jungleized, if you like. So you're very much right. That is a big part of it. The palpable fear that I feel when I visit Forks, Washington, Darrington, Washington, Oak Ridge, Oregon, Sweet Home, Oregon, and I have coffee and eggs and bacon. I've lost it, folks. I leave tomorrow. When I sit down in those little cafes, and I can tell an awful lot about how I'm received because I'm in uniform, they don't usually know me. And so I'm Forest Service from out of town. And sometimes it's just kind of cold eyeballs. But a lot of times, sooner or later, somebody approaches me and introduces himself or asks me who I am, what the hell I'm doing there, or whatever. And we get into conversation. It's really scary in some towns like Forks. Those people are so afraid they've turned to hate. They've taught their children hate. When you look at the vacant store windows in Forks, Washington, and the sixth grade art is posted there with gallows holding spotted owl bodies, and death to the Forest Service, and anyone else that happens to be a target of the hate, it is very scary. And our young ranger, Ben Worthington, there is struggling hard to hold that community together. It's difficult in some communities for Forest Service children to go to school. And so, make no mistake about it, there is great fear, and it's earned fear, because the cut is going down. We said that in the forest plants long before spotted owl. 25% reduction in this region is inevitable. It will probably be greater than that as a result of the spotted owls. And I posted here, we can't possibly discuss here, but for anybody intensely interested on what the committee report is for habitat conservation areas, which would protect the future of the spotted owls, I'll show you what those impacts would be on individual or collective forests in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. That has not been implemented yet. But that's a major question. To what extent can we produce resources and meet these not lofty, but absolutely essential goals of responsibility to ecosystems? So it's a part of the search for compatibilities, and it's only a search. It's not a finding yet. Tom.
You talk about social justice, and it's a real common theme to relate social justice and the ability to give everybody a home to live in and to allow wood products out there and with good cause. I guess my big concern is that I don't see it happening. I don't see any poor people getting better housing because we're cutting down our national forests. What I see is basically a timber industry making 62% profit on exported logs through third-party substitutions, through direct substitutions. And so I think when you talk about social justice, you can't forget that you're dealing with the timber industry. That's basically a multinational corporation trying to make as much profit for a small group of people. And so I guess on that level, I'm real concerned. I think that if we would start to work on limiting our exports, and that's not that simple. I understand about balance of trade and the whole bit. But if we started to reduce our exports of logs from national forests, if we just eliminated those exports, for a few years we'd probably have less cutting in national forests. But ultimately, towns like Skykomish and all the other places in Washington that and have the small mills may come back, because we would begin to mill our own products again.
I couldn't agree more with Tom, except I do want to set straight this. He understands the complexity, but it is against the law and has been since Senator Wayne Morse was in the Congress to export national forest logs. However, there are loopholes in that law that do allow forms of substitution. That's what he was alluding to. The bottom line is, we are behaving as a third world country when we export one log. And it is to the great credit of the Japanese that they are so efficient, they can take a log and take it across the United States and mill it and sell products back to us. The Yankee trader has lost his skill or hers. And so it's, you know, it is time for many reasons to address that question. In terms of industry self-interest, you couldn't be more right. Most of the people in the mill towns do not, most mill towns don't blame the Forest Service or the environmentalists for unemployment, because they've been experiencing mill closures throughout my career. I started in Mapleton, Oregon. There were 8 mills purchasing, local mills purchasing National Forest timber. Davidson Industries is there today. The other 7 are gone. There has been a mill in every town or small city that I've worked in the Forest Service in Oregon and Washington that has been one or more that's been closed in every town I've ever worked in. So it is obvious, I think, to everybody the industry has not shown a great deal of concern for their own employees. And it's usually in the newspaper, the loggers. Well, in fact, the loggers aren't the people in jeopardy of all. Loggers is a rare skill. It's the mill workers and it's the truck drivers. Loggers left the Northwest to go log Hugo. Loggers left the Northwest to log in the Tongass. Loggers are not, children are not replacing loggers, because many loggers have, some loggers like their son to follow in the footsteps or footsteps of their daughter, which is happening, by the way. But most that I know want a better life for their kids. It's the most dangerous job in the United States by industrial accident